I'm just going to launch straight into a little kind of intro case study, which I think it always works quite nicely in these kinds of presentations. So between the 9th and 11th of November 1946, in retaliation for attacks on Hindu pilgrims travelling from the Garmukhtasar fair in the Meerut area of western Uttar Pradesh, a huge and apparently coordinated attack took place on a number of Muslim villages, leading to, according to reports of the United Provinces Provincial Congress Committee, 416 deaths and over 500 arrests. Mrijula Sarabhai, a Congress worker who was later to head up operations to recover abducted women following partition, described how during the violence no Hindu slogans were chanted, but instead the battle cries of the Congress rang out and the Congress flag was flown. For Sarabhai, the explanation was that this was a well-organised and anti-national group sailing under the name of the Congress and its volunteer organisation, the Congress Seva Dal. Congress observers were baffled as to why this had happened, not least because the upcoming Congress session in Meerut on the 20th of November now seemed to be in peril. Something had to be done, evidence had to be gathered and reports had to be made. When I wrote about this episode in a book I published, that Faisal just mentioned, in 2004, I was fascinated by the ways in which, in this case, the RSS in particular had come to be associated with Congress volunteer movements. For Sarabhai, the associations were clear and in some ways obvious, especially through the semi-military organisations and their changing behaviour through the 1940s. What was interesting, though, for me revisiting this was less the, as it were, the associations we see between the RSS and the Congress, but what it meant for wider questions about violence and about power and the exercise of power by these semi-military volunteer organisations. So this paper looks at the background to that incident in November 1946, and it draws on research that I did in the early 2000s relating to that first 2004 book, which I've subsequently revisited in 2012, but which now I've decided I'd like to rethink in relation to work I've done around partition and its immediate aftermath. And of course, as many people will know, whenever there's a seven in the date, every 10 years, we're asked to kind of talk about independence and partition. Well, I seem to be asked to talk about independence and partition, so that's another reason why this is being kind of brought up again. The arguments that I made in my 2004 book have, in interesting ways, undergone some changes for me, which have reflected changing events in India itself, but also specifically what's happened politically in India around the election of Narendra Modi. I argued in my book that we really need to find some of the most important trends in the development of Hindu nationalism in institutions, public spaces, and ideological trends that sat outside or alongside the obvious organisations of the Hindu right. In other words, that the real roots of the Hindu right in contemporary India actually lay in some ways, on the one hand, within ostensibly secular institutions, and on the other, in forms of popular mobilisation, often driven by those institutions in areas like UP. So my thinking about this older work, specifically about semi-military volunteer organisations that I'm going to talk about in detail in a moment, has also changed as a result of new research I've done around partition and its immediate aftermath. In a recent project I'm working on at the moment, a book I'm working on with Sarah Ansari, where we're exploring citizenship, I've been interested in the idea of the interrelationship of different spaces, and in particular cities, across North India and across the border into Pakistan, in generating ideas about the citizen in India and Pakistan. And this has changed my view in some ways of the data around these volunteer movements in two ways, principally. Firstly, doing work on the nature of political networks around this mid to late 1940s period across parts of UP, around popular perceptions of the state, corruption, citizenship, and how they manifest themselves in factions and forms of political patronage, has made me think about, as it were, the politics of scale in a different kind of way. And it's occurred to me that we might look at the material around the volunteer movements of the 1940s, bearing in mind these changing networks and these changing scales of politics. Secondly, I've started to think in new ways about the ideological and organisational drivers for some of these semi-military movements, and especially why these spaces for semi-fascist authoritarian structures opened up, what Ben Zachariah has described as fascist repertoires. In the second part of the paper, I'm going to talk about this in relation to Nehru's nemesis, Purushottam Das Tandon. And in this, I think there's some interesting things to say about, firstly, ideas about the future citizen of India, and secondly, notions of spaces of sovereignty in terms of the exercise of violence. As George Chatterjee has also shown, the formal structures of citizenship were to a great extent determined by the contingent movement and displacement of people across the border around partition. For Chatterjee, this is a movement from jus soli to jus sanguinis, or the displacement of civic notions of the citizen to ethnic ones, as the displacement of populations on the basis of religion forced citizenship to be strictly defined along religious lines. However, discussions around the volunteer movements, especially those espoused by Tandon, represented a level at which ethnic notions of citizenship were already formed, especially via representations of Pakistan. We know from recent work on partition that the idea of Pakistan was driven to a great extent by responses to the refugee crisis, migration, but also, and crucially, this reasoning about the boundaries of the state in terms of military power or the sovereignty of violence. And it's here that the work of Thomas Blom Hansen is also important to what I'm going to present today, in exploring this tenuous and distributed form of sovereignty in states such as India and its implications for these proto-forms of citizenship, something which I'm going to turn to later in the talk in relation to these semi-military organisations. For now, what is distinctive about the 1940s is its power as a moment when typical forms of sovereignty are loosened, when violence comes to determine ideas of the body politic in new ways, and the questions of rights in relation to territory are fluid and in transition. So today I'm going to look at some of these themes and questions by proposing a different way of thinking about how violence was changing in 1940s UP, or how certain kinds of fluid institutions were invested in that violence. And I'm going to make some slightly bold, and I hesitate to say, new arguments about the terms like an old dog with new clothes. No, old dog, new tricks. Yeah, some new arguments about this in terms of how we might rethink these loose volunteer organisations in terms of the spatial scales across the UP region, giving us some clues about how violence spreads and is perpetuated leading up to partition itself. Finally, by looking at the politics of Tandon, I'm going to explore its wider and more long-term ideological implications for thinking about the citizen in India and its exclusions. So what are these semi-military organisations that I've just quickly introduced? Why did they emerge at this time in the 30s and late 30s and 40s, or develop at this time, and why so strongly in states like UP? The answer to these questions can be broadly divided into two areas. Firstly, as I'm sure many people are aware, the context of European fascism and then global war from the late 30s and 40s, which had its influence on the growth of these sorts of movements. And secondly, the specific political conditions of the province of UP itself and regions within it. I'm not going to deal with the issue of European fascism much today in the interwar period, which has recently been covered very well by Ali Raza and Francisca Roy, but we'll focus more on their rapid growth and political expansion, by which I mean the spatial expansion as well as demographic change in this important period, the late 1930s and 1940s. And I get to look at the ways in which they change fundamentally in the kinds of politics they get involved with. The first and most important thing to note about volunteer movements is that they transformed in important ways over this period, from movements related to specific forms of city policing and militia work into potential national militias, I would argue. The data we have about them was coloured by colonial state security anxieties, which reflect this shift as well, including in archival files exploring these movements are categorisations around whether or not these movements were related to the Congress or to Hindu organisations or to Muslim organisations. As a result, we have the service-oriented youth and volunteer movements of the Congress, sometimes associated or overlapping with, in these documents, more militant-style organisations like the RSS or eventually the Muslim League National Guard. In their origins, many of these movements evolved out of urban-based volunteer corps, originally started to protect communities during religious festivals in the early to mid-1930s. For example, in Kanpur, in the big industrial city in UP, we have volunteer organisations set up to protect Hindu vegetable sellers in the Sabji Mandi, to defend vendors against perceived Muslim competition. In Banaras, we see Muslim and Hindu Defence Corps forming at the time of the Holi and Ramlila festivals, various groups of Mahabir Dals, groups of the brave, forming in that city too, building themselves on the local Akara or gymnasium culture. In this sense, these organisations could be quite short-lived with specific functions. But the state was somewhat justified in including or juxtaposing the Congress movements with the so-called communal ones, the Hindu-Muslim ones. These two joined in for the policing of religious festivals, using some of the same ideas of Hindu organisation and competing essentially with the same Hindu constituencies. In looking at these movements for physical culture, there are various social bases to consider, and Joseph Alter has shown how the activities of the Akara were popularized among middle and lower middle class small town dwellers, appealing to the specific political worldviews of that section of North India's population. On the other hand, Nandini Guptu has pointed out that there are also burgeoning and growing lower caste movements presenting themselves as defenders of Hinduism in some of these big cities like Kanpur. I'm going to suggest that these movements, therefore, are quite heterogeneous in terms of their social, as it were, support, not easily connected to specific classes or communities, although there were some sectional ones in different cities. There were also, however, importantly, strong ideological factors in the development of these movements for physical culture, volunteer movements being associated, of course, with the Congress's ideas and rituals of individual discipline. The Gandhian ideas of self-discipline, with which we're all aware, which were shared quite widely within the UP Congress among people like Sri Prakash, Mahabir Tyagi, and various other leaders in that part of the India. Okay, arguably there were. Now let me just try and get this to work. That one. There we go. Arguably there were some important psychological and status-related reasons for the growth of these movements. Official reports noted that, in some measure, the volunteer organisations owe their popularity, if not their origin, to the lure of the uniform, as we can see clearly in this image. It's impossible not to observe the pathetic anxiety of all volunteer bodies to model themselves on the pattern of the military and police and police forces. The Hindustani Seva Dal, for example, pictured here, wore khaki shirts and blue shorts and helped to maintain order at Congress functions. Recent work on this group has shown how its activities by the early 30s certainly attempted to build parallel military and security structures to the state itself, with the aim of eventually making colonial administration obsolete. Special terms for commanders, notions of military units, organisation via drilling was used in developing these organisations. And crucially, as I'll explore a bit more later in relation to P.D. Tandon, its further functions were to protect, quote, in the mission statement of the Seva Dal, the life, property and honour of Indian citizens. Looking at these volunteer organisations over a longer period of time, though, suggests that by the late 1930s, their function and purpose had begun to change in fundamental ways. Whereas volunteer movements, as Nandini Guptu notes, grew out of specific local urban disputes or forms of policing in the early 1930s, at the outbreak of the war, they started to connect and network across the province. And this process was begun by the context of provincial Congress ministries in areas like UP, where, as I'm going to argue in a moment, suggests that such movements were also linked to networks of political patronage over the 30s and 1940s, the Congress system, as it were, in formation. By October 1939, shortly after the declaration of war, the building of volunteer movements started to increase rapidly. The total number of organisations fluctuated a great deal between 1938 and 1942, a period for which the UP government kept some estimates as to the size of the organisations. And certainly there appeared to be a cultural and functional change with the outbreak of war from 1939. Evidence for this provincial widening out, or for what Stephen Legg has described as scaling of politics, can be found in three things, which I'm going to move into step by step in the next bit of the paper. Firstly, the organisational aspects of the movement as challenges to the colonial monopoly of securitised space. Secondly, the new scales of factional and patronage politics as they connected to provincial politics as that widened out in the late 30s. And finally, the growing competition between Hindu and Muslim organisations. So taking that first point, the organisational changes in these movements in the late 30s and 40s, we can see from 1938 provincial and nationwide training centres for volunteers beginning to develop. Throughout 1938, intelligence noted that volunteer movements had been particularly successful in the UP, with an actual military department of the Provincial Congress Committee, with specific training camps along military lines set up in locations across the province, in some cases led by the actual education minister of the UP administration, Sampunanand. For example, we have a formation of the Komi Seva Dal board under R.S. Pandit, increasing by 3,000 over the space of 6 months to about 25,000 members following the outbreak of war. Equally, the Muslim National Guards had clearly made huge strides in recruitment in the Congress-led administrative provinces. In UP, for example, that increased from 15,000 to 18,448 in the space of 6 months up to the end of the ministry period in September 1939. In December 1938, the UP Provincial Congress Committee set up semi-military-style training camps for the whole province in Ayodhya, which was intended as a nucleus for an all-India corps. Officials noted that its appeal mostly remained in UP itself. However, its organiser, Nand Kumar Dev, Vashishta, discussed a hope that it would raise a force of 1 lakh by 1940, which would be trained on police and military lines. At one such camp, Vashishta reportedly claimed that as soon as Congress had effected a strong corps capable of administering law and order, Congress ministries would create a crisis and order city and district Congress committees to take administration into their own hands. And so by June 1938, towards the end of the Congress ministry period, these training camps had spread across the province, as well as Aligarh, Mathura, Ghazipur, Jhansi, Jaunpur, Kanpur, Farrukhabad, Budaun, Unnao, Bharuch, Meerut, Azamgarh, Pilibhit and Gorakhpur. We have these camps being set up. These forms of organisation were absolutely then about the challenge to colonial control of public security and the spaces those instruments of governance implied. The UP was exercised by the insistence, for example, of Jawaharlal Nehru, that despite orders to ban military-style drilling in early August 1940, a military-style Congress volunteer procession should still take place in Kanpur and Allahabad in those two cities. At first, the local Congress committees had sought permission under the Police Act, but this was opposed by Nehru, who went ahead in taking part in the Allahabad procession, accompanied by the Seva Dal and other volunteers armed with lathis on the 15th of August. So in terms of, as it were, towards the end of the Congress period, what we see is a kind of opening out of these movements into something that really looks much more like a serious sort of attempt to, as it were, parallel security and police forces across UP. But I'm going to look now at a second, factor in, as it were, the development of these movements, and that is around the changing scales of political patronage and political, as it were, practice and mobilisation across UP in the late 1930s. Just as the Congress became the base point for a range of other parties who had to cut deals with its committees and leadership for influence in a locality, similarly, political volunteer movements, by their nature, allowed institutions to share members and resources more than they might have done otherwise. So we see parallel relationships between the Congress, the Hindu Sabhas, the Mahabir Dals, the RSS on the one side, and the Congress Muslim League and Volunteers and Khakhsars, the Muslim organisations on the other. This combination revealed other patterns. Throughout the 1930s and 40s, there were not always clear delineations in personnel and training between the supposedly Congress-sponsored movements and organisations for Hindu defence, such as the Mahabir Dal, the Hanuman Dal, the Arya Dal, and the RSS itself. So, for example, in September 1938, in the district of Etah, the Congress Sevak Dal joined with the Mahabir Dal to escort a particular religious procession through the city. And we see these two volunteer organisations jointly organising the policing of processions. We see the same thing happening in Dehradun around Gandhi Day, which involved the joint policing of crowds by the Mahabir Dal, the Congress Sevak Dal, the Sikh Guru Dal volunteers. And in lots of other districts across UP, we see this sort of, as it were, coordination of activity between the supposedly secular organisations and the supposedly communal organisations, which leads to a kind of, you could say, a confusion of categories between these groups. And in some cases, leading to instances of what the colonial observers saw as forms of violence and rioting. In other districts and cities, the Congress outwardly relied upon the already existing Hindu organisation to strengthen their own core. So, for example, in Allahabad in January 1940, congressmen decided to organise the various Hindu communities and parties into one volunteer group. And by mid-1940, it was becoming difficult in some districts for official observers to distinguish, differentiate between these groups. In other ways, these volunteer movements mapped onto forms of political patronage and networking, which by the late 1930s took place in a more province-wide fashion, as you would expect, given provincial autonomy. That the movements were used for short-term and electoral purposes was demonstrated by their highly flexible nature and their transience, in fact. An Intelligence Bureau note observed that the country is full of mushroom organisations, created to meet the exigencies of the moment and then forgotten, seldom properly organised or systematically developed, without central control or financial backing, owing allegiance to nobody, or what is worse, to a local faction or a faction's busybody. The volunteer movements were also significant in the development of factional electoral politics then. We can see this to an extent in the support bases of some of the key UP figures of the late 1930s, Algar Ray Shastri, who linked movements across the entire province. And in a general sense, we can see it in the correlation between their activities and elections. In the eastern part of UP, for example, according to official figures, the growth of volunteer movements in one short period of the late 1930s was linked to the specific district of Gorakhpur and the assembly by-elections that were taking place. Not surprisingly then, by the time of the 1945 to 1946 elections, it was clear that some of the Hindu volunteer organisations were assisting the Congress in election work. This was directly reported in the Meerut region in Western UP, and when we look at the election complaints for this area in the 1951 state elections, again we see suggestions of relationship between volunteer organisations and election activity going back to 1946. Okay, I'm going to move on to the third factor for the change in these organisations in the late 30s and 40s, and that is with the outbreak of the war and the coming to the end of the ministry period, the growth of these organisations around forms of Hindu or religious or Hindu-Muslim competition between, as it were, the Hindu organisations and the Muslim ones. The growth of Muslim League organisations in UP increased significantly, you can see when you look at the figures, for some parts of UP in response to the expansion of Congress groups. Over the last 6 months of the ministry period, the Muslim League National Guard, for example, increased from 15,000 to 18,500. With the capitulation of France, there was an increase in volunteer organisation activity as well. For example, in the first half of 1940, the membership of Congress organisations increased to more than 30,000. And this is an increase of more than about 8,000 in 1 year, crucially introducing military drill alongside social work. At the same time, we have these kind of military boards, national defence boards being set up in the period of the first part of the Second World War, in which we have the province divided into divisions by both the Congress organisations and the Muslim League and National Guard organisations, involving drilling and involving forms of military organisation, which creates a sort of competitive sort of politics between the Muslim League organisations and the Congress ones. At the same time, what we also have by the mid-1940s is a kind of proliferation of these sort of miscellaneous Hindu organisations whose, as it were, association with the Congress is increasingly ambiguous. So a collection of organisations with by mid-1940, a membership of around 9,400, including the Bajrang Dal, what's called the Bajrang Dal, the Hanuman Dal, an organisation called the Kesri Dal in Allahabad, an organisation called the Hindu Sangh in Kanpur and Lucknow, the Arya Veer Dal in Ghazapur and Lucknow, the Hindu Raksha Dal in Jhansi. Perhaps most importantly, we see a correlation between forms of rapid growth of both Hindu and Muslim organisations in certain districts, particularly in the west of the province, as I'm going to show you in a moment, in the data itself, when we look at the data in more detail. So alongside these province-wide activities of the Congress, these miscellaneous Hindu and Muslim organisations, Muslim League organisations, we also have, as people probably already know, this big drive by the Hindu Mahasabha and the Hindu Sabhas in relation to military recruitment. And again, this links, in the same way that the Congress links to larger global and national events, the growth of the Hindu Mahasabha organisations links very much to the Lahore Resolution, which once circulated leads on to the growth of Hindu Mahasabha-related volunteer organisations. I'm not going to go into detail on that because that's a whole kind of separate sort of paper, really, but the UP Provincial Hindu Sabha stepped up its organisation of a provincial Hindu militarisation board in 1941, following that politics, that national politics and the implications of it. And we see this sort of specific militarisation drive of the Hindu Mahasabha through that period of 1941-2, so that by the beginning of 1942, the new active approach to the Mahasabha leads to the kind of new popularity of the Mahasabha in various sort of mass meetings in the big cities of UP. Okay, so all in all, we can see that what happens with the volunteer movements more than likely had a significant knock-on effect on the forms of violence that we see by the mid-1940s in UP. Perhaps even, I'm going to argue, transformed it in a way beyond recognition from what we see happening in the 1930s. And I'm also going to argue that this sort of set the scene for the forms of violence that seem to take place around partition as well in 1947. So there's been quite a bit of work over the last 15 years looking at the extent to which certain kinds of civic or political conditions shape the forms and terms of communal violence, as we know it, both as representation and as practice. In his book, The Production of Hindu-Muslim Violence, Paul Brass, for example, argues that the conjunction of governance and the needs of political mobilisation produce particular forms of Hindu-Muslim confrontation in contemporary India. Ashutosh Varshney examined the specific urban locations where violence was rare and related it to the successful functioning of institutions of civil society. Stephen Wilkinson has gathered a huge amount of data to explore the incidence of violence in relation to certain kinds of electoral conditions in contemporary India. A missing dynamic in some ways of this theorization of how, where and why this kind of violence takes place is arguably its lack of temporality, or its sort of weak temporality, temporal sort of, as it were, structure. And secondly, the nature of political scale and movement of resources of violence across different spaces, both physical and ideological. And I'm going to present, I suppose, a very hesitant little model for how I think that happens through these volunteer movements in the 1940s. Looking at the stages in the development of the volunteer movements gives us a sense of how forms of organised violence were associated with expanding political frameworks. And in this section, I'm going to explore this by finding some connections between the nature, growth and shape of movements and the ensuing violence around the 1946 election specifically, where we have a lot of riots and events that seem to be linked into the activities of these movements. Principally, I'm going to argue that local movements scaled up to respond to regional political changes, and to national changes at the centre of Indian politics. I think the flexibility and the peculiar kind of localism of these movements as they changed and extended was in many ways one of the reasons, firstly, why such organisations could be and were linked to political events and changes in the UP, since they were able to kind of, as it were, adapt and react to changes in politics very, very quickly. And you had the means, as it were, if you were a political patron, the means to violence, to use the force when you needed to in a political situation. And secondly, this explains the fluidity of the recruitment itself, the changeable nature of how large these organisations, and also the nature of the violence being unpredictable to some extent. So I think the unpredictability of the movements themselves, where they're involved in violence, leads to the changing form of the violence itself. And I'm going to just quickly give you a very quick example of this in a very well-documented riot that took place in February 1939 in the city of Kanpur, the largest industrial city of UP. Here, an apparent dispute over music before mosques escalated into a large-scale riot as a result of the rapid mobilisation of Muslim League and Congress volunteer movements. The result was, according to police and newspaper accounts, more of a pitched battle across the city's Meston Road on the 12th of February 1939. And on the 19th of February, the Pioneer reported that the same groups that had been rapidly mobilised during the violence were then doing relief work. By the 22nd of February, new volunteer corps were being organised under the auspices of the Hindu Sangh, which continued to have a role in the promotion of the rights of local Hindu communities in negotiating the terms of peace between the communities in the city. So this relationship between volunteer organisations and violence then was complex, but was part of the reproduction of the violence in any particular place. Firstly, the existence of organised corps affected the form of violence, in this case, a kind of pitched battle across a road of the city. Secondly, volunteer movements were a means of force for local political leaders for whom such violence was a dynamic of institutional authority. And thirdly, such groups were sometimes formed around the process of reconciliation and peace as well, as the riot was resolved. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is present to you what I think is a kind of a correlation between the changing, as it were, structures of the volunteer movements across UP and the incidence of communal violence in particular parts of the province. And I'm particularly interested in the west side of UP, where we start to see, by the mid-1940s, a relatively large number of what seem to be communal conflicts, particularly around or just following the elections of 1945 to 1946, and particularly in areas like Meerut and Agra in western UP. Official observers looking at what was happening in the early to mid-1940s with these movements talked about made two particular observations in their analysis of what was going on. Firstly, they pointed out the extent to which the gains in Hindu organisations often came at the expense of Congress volunteer recruitment and vice versa. So that, in other words, there was a sort of correlation between, or nexus between, the Congress and the Hindu movements, which would suggest that when, as it were, the politics of cities are changing, that there are certain ways in which these movements are increasingly interchangeable, or communalised, we could say. Secondly, and most importantly, another observation was that the Muslim organizations were active mostly in those provinces where Congress are in the majority. And this seemed to apply also in districts. So we see this sort of form of competitive mobilization taking place in certain parts of UP, which I'm going to argue had a little bit of a had an effect on the pattern of the violence as it took place. So we have this competitive consolidation effect, one could say, around these movements when we look at them, when we map them out. So I'm going to now kind of present that in some of the data that I don't know whether you can see this very well, that I've put together on these movements. I've divided up, as it were, the official reports on the numbers for volunteers in of these different movements in different districts across the west, central, and east.
Can you raise the chart?
Say again?
Can you raise the chart?
So can we raise it up slightly? Can you go higher? Is that okay? Yeah. So I'm going to kind of move between these three. This is the really exciting bit, looking at tables of figures. I'm going to go between these three tables just to kind of point out a couple of things that I thought were quite interesting about what was happening in different parts of UP. So if we look at, for example, the districts of Western UP, what we've got there are across the top, we have the names of some of the main volunteer organisations, the Congress-related organisations, Muslim League National Guards, the Khaksars Muslim Organisation, the Mohammed Dal, and Miscellaneous Hindu. There are various other categories of volunteer organisations that I didn't include in the table that I didn't think didn't make a substantial difference to the overall results of what I was looking at. I then obviously looked at the total those up, and I looked at the in relation to the city population. But what I did was I looked at the percentage increase in the size of the volunteer organisations over the period from the end of the Congress ministry through to March 1942. If we look at that column, it says vol percentage increase. We have some figures that show the increases. And what's interesting for Western UP, if we look at that column, compared to some other parts of UP, is that there seems to be an overall increase. We see an overall increase in figures and the membership of these organisations. If we look at, for example, Central UP, in some areas there's some increases in some districts, but some are stagnant, some are actually in decline by 42. And then in Eastern UP, we have some large increases, for example, in Gorakhpur district, a little bit in Azamgarh in Eastern UP. But again, quite a lot of decline as well. So overall in the Western UP, what we see is a kind of more consistent increase in numbers of volunteers. More interesting aspect, I think, is also the ratio. I worked out the ratio of the organisations over this period of time as a kind of an aggregate. And what we see is a kind of quite a close ratio between the Hindu organisations and the Muslim organisations in Western UP. So we have, if we look at the ratios on the far to far right columns, we can see I've kind of divided it between Hindu Muslim and Congress Muslim League. Obviously there's a slight difference between those two things, but we see a fairly close ratio in most districts, which of course is affected by the demography of the district itself, but even taking into account the demography of the district, the ratio is particularly close, I think, when we compare them to, given that most of these movements are based in cities, when we
care. Think that all are men.
Say again?
We're only talking about men, are we?
Yes, I think principally only men, yeah, although there probably were some women in some of these organisations. If we look at Central UP, we can see much, kind of as it were, wider ratios, and equally in Eastern UP, wide ratios. In other words, much more dominant Congress volunteer organisations in Central and Eastern UP. So then what I did was I thought it might be interesting to look at that in relation to what happens in terms of the violence that took place in and around the 1945 to 1946 elections. Now this is where I'm skating possibly on thin ice, but I think there may be something in this. If we look at the riots that take place shortly following the 1946 elections through the sort of winter to spring of 1946, we can see quite a distinctive clustering in those districts and areas of Western UP, those areas where we have this kind of closer correlation, this closer ratio of Hindu-Muslim volunteer organisation activity, but also where we have a more consistent growth in the number of volunteers in those places. Okay, so I think there are a number of possible implications to this. I should get on to P.D. Tandon, because it's only got about 20 minutes left, sorry about that. I'll quickly summarise the implications of this. I think one of the most interesting implications is that, apart from the obvious point that, there does seem to be a bit of a correlation around the specific kinds of Western UP volunteer organisation development and the incidence of violence by the mid-1940s, I think the other interesting thing about this is that the, as it were, the organised semi-militarised violence that we see around partition itself, that Stephen Wilkinson has written about in very interesting ways in relation to demobilised soldiers and that having an effect on violence, we might say is pre, as it were, prefigured by what's happening in Western UP specifically. Going back to the opening example I gave in Meerut, again, we could say that there are certain kinds of systematic, formal, semi-formal kinds of organised violence that are taking place well before partition actually takes place. Okay, or even partition is thought to be happening. Right, so I'm going to move on to the final bit of the paper now, which is to look at some of the, one particular leader. When I did this book in 2004, I looked at the leadership of some of these volunteer movements and organisations, and it's clear that there were some specific political patrons or promoters of drilling and semi-militaristic organisation who popped up in intelligence reports repeatedly. And I find this connection between a certain group of Congress leaders in UP who were, to an extent, supporting forms of Hindu mobilisation and who were active in volunteering. Algar Ray Shastri, Mahabir Tyagi, for example, and a range of other sort of lesser figures across the province. But the most interesting and perhaps significant and beguiling figure was the challenger to Nehru himself, shortly following independence, P.D. Tandon, customarily given the title of Rajarshi, or Royal Saint. Connecting the politics of the locality and the province to the national level, where for 1950, for a while, he successfully usurped Nehru as Congress president, Tandon represented what I would describe as an alternative political trajectory to what historians have seen as a Nehruvian consensus in India. And here he is on the far right of the image there, on the First Republic Day, next to Nehru. Okay. So in this final section, I'm going to quickly look at the ideas that drove Tandon's support of volunteer and drilling movements of the kind I've been describing, looking at a specific example connected to him, the Hind Rakshak Dal, and explore some of the implications of his politics in the light of what we've discussed so far. And I'm going to argue that Tandon's perspective presented two important trends. Firstly, a deliberate and distinctive critique of what he saw as the mainstream Congress non-violent anti-colonialism, which had implications for how volunteer movements could associate with concepts of national freedom and connections between sovereignty and violence. And secondly, a clearly ethnicised notion of citizenship identity, which then had a knock-on effect following independence. So Tandon took an initial interest in Congress in 1906, was in charge of the Hindi Sahitya Sammelan, who was a huge patron of Hindi from its inception in 1910. But from the beginning of civil disobedience in 1930, he became president of the Allahabad District Congress Committee. And for most of the 1930s, he combines a form of Congress socialism, in fact, with revivalist political techniques. So quite an interesting figure politically, evoking often in his speeches and his writings and his political style, religious sort of a religious idiom and religious themes. Tandon was described as the Gandhi of UP, and he certainly shared the Mahatma's fondness for austerity, penchant for raw food, which he ate for most of his political life, and his disdain for Western medicine, by which he claimed the drugged could never live a healthy life. I'm not sure whether Gandhi, however, actually drank a cup of cow's urine every day, but apparently, allegedly, this is what Tandon did. His politics were distinctly anti-Gandhian in one important respect. Throughout the mid-1940s, Tandon advocated in varying forms the need to ditch the non-violence of the Mahatma and to encourage a politics of community defence. At first, his interest in volunteer movements grew out of Congress-related activities. Intelligence sources observed that on the 6th of July 1940, he met with Krishnakant Malavi to discuss the need to establish a national defence force. And perhaps most notoriously, on the 5th of November of the same year at Allahabad University, Tandon tried to persuade students to follow the example of their German counterparts in their admiration for the Führer. By 1945, his direct anti-Gandhian principles had come out into the open. And between August 45 and February 46, he inaugurated a number of camps for the training of Congress volunteers, in some cases using weapons, in Allahabad, Barau, and Ray Bareilly, and himself engaged in direct vocal opposition to what he described as Gandhi's policy of appeasement of Muslims. From June 1947, Tandon was the key leader behind a new anti-Pakistan Hindu volunteer movement, the Hind Rakshak Dal, as it was called, which espoused a notion of homeland defence, in which homeland was conjured up less as a territory, I would argue, than as a cultural edifice, a theme which P.D. Tandon came back to repeatedly. Unfortunately, we don't have that much information on the movements themselves and its scope and scale, but it was referred to intermittently in the press and was the focus of quite a lot of correspondence between Tandon and a range of other organisations in the UP and further afield. The timing of the Hindrakshak Dal and its inauguration with the decision took place in relation to the decision of the central negotiations to agree to the partition of India at the start of June. The movement can therefore be seen as a direct and rapid response to the precipitate changes at the centre. It also represented a consolidation, I would say, of an anti-Pakistan position that had been evident in the volunteer movements of earlier years, on the one hand, and a tendency for a new line of anti-Gandhian politics within the UP Congress. But more significantly, I would argue that it illustrated a new dynamic in how we might think about the distributed operation of sovereignty as the exercise of violence in 1947. The Hindrakshak Dal drew on a broad constituency of multi-sided anti-Muslim causes. This was partly the result of its advocacy and leadership by Tandon, whose position was all Indian and which connected down to particular cities in UP too. But it's also an indication of a wider opening up of the political field for militant right-wing politics, driven by territorial insecurity in the way that we can see in other contexts and times. If sovereignty is at one level an exercise in the assertion of legitimacy, then the Hindrakshak Dal helped to establish for a time a new kind of legitimate space for militant Hindu chauvinism and fascism, which was given the trappings and associations of the All Indian Secular Congress. In the responses to Tandon's proposals for the Hindrakshak Dal, we can see this process of Congress Hindu consolidation and re-legitimation at work. Local Congress committees in UP, as well as individuals, wrote to Tandon offering support. One letter from the Bareilly Town Congress Committee asked for the Bareilly Congress organisations to be allied to the Rakshak Dal. The Congress Committee of Mathura, also in Western UP again, and the Student Congress Corps sent their support. Many North Indian responses to the Hindrakshak Dal came from these Western districts of UP and a range of cultural institutions too, educational institutions such as the Hapur Agricultural College in Meerut and the DS High School in Aragarh. But at the same time, this theme of consolidation led in one case to a Dalit organisation agreeing to ally with the Dal as a new form of Hindu defence. Volunteers of the Harijan Senik Shala Sidapur decided to work along the lines suggested by Tandon for Hindrakshak Dal on the 14th of June 1947. And the organisation chalked out a scheme to start up a Dal in every four or five villages of the district. The connections to the Hindu far right itself were equally enthusiastic, illustrating the broad fantasies of a violently defended and exclusively Hindu future. Kalyan Chand Mohile, secretary of the Hindu Mahasabha and resident of Allahabad, wrote to Tandon, for example, suggesting a more widespread introduction of military training for young men. One RSS correspondent heavily criticised Gandhi for the carnage of partition and suggested the setting up of a shadow cabinet, which would include the RSS Guruji and Dr. B.S. Munje, Tandon and Acharya J.B. Kripalani. Another Hindu Mahasabha supporter, T.S. Sharma of Kanpur, wrote to Tandon to support his scheme with the prayer, "May God guide the man in authority, not to place any obstacles in the way so that even belated steps can be taken to prevent the threatened extinction of the Hindu race." Other organisations across India tapped into this conceptual territory of Hindu India. There is a declaration of support, for example, from the Andhra Socialist Party, who declared that Muslim nationalism is rising and we must guard against it. In this case, reference being made to the politics of Hyderabad. In these ideas of community defence, I would argue Tandon was promoting an alternative notion of sovereignty, which bears some resemblance to what Thomas Blom Hansen has described as quotidian notions of violent justice, where sovereignty is not found in law or legitimate rule as such, but in tentative and always emergent forms of authority grounded in violence. This violence that is performed and designed to generate loyalty, fear and legitimacy, I think, characterises in some ways some of the kind of activities of these volunteer movements like the Hindrakshak Dal. In the colonial world, different kinds and registers of sovereignty overlapped and coexisted, a situation generated by the actual fragmented and distributed forms of local authority. We can see a late colonial and early post-colonial India as a playing out of what Hansen sees as a twilight zone of exceptions and lawlessness, allowing for unrestrained violence and exploitation, an imaginary canvas on which liberal arguments for the necessity of rights and rule of law could be made. And the mid-1940s is particularly crucial for examining the shifting grounds of these registers of sovereignty and these ambiguous areas of sovereignty. In this sense, the Hindratschak Dal and organisations like it, rather than being invested in the formal idea of the state, were invested in more distributed and alternative notions of sovereign power. Arguably, volunteer movements generated zones of exception in areas and times where the boundaries of power were shifting, such as 1946-7. At this time, formal sites of sovereignty were rapidly changing, opening up what we might describe as informal sites, fantasies of shadow cabinets of the kind that were written about in Tandon, to protect the Hindu half, the formation of militias, the intermittent but unstable pooling of resources between factional leaders and communal organisations. At another level, these organisations represented the increasing exercise of community policing, in which segments of or zones of state sovereignty were increasingly seen as ineffective. Perhaps most significant in the Hindratschak Dal and Tandon's politics is the explicit call to violence, though, in response to an alternative perceived sovereignty, that of Pakistan, in which the rights of Muslims are seen as ones of exception or bare life, to use Agamben's bodily idea of sovereignty. And it's this last point that I'm going to look at just very quickly in 5 minutes, sorry, I'm overrunning a little bit, in looking at how Tandon talks about the idea of the citizen. So just as Gandhi allowed certain ideological commitments to run through his entire political engagement, Tandon's espousal of Hindu unity through volunteer organisation linked to a range of other cultural activities for him, which were obviously very much tied up with this idea of volunteer organisation and mobilisation. And it's through this that the idea of the citizen in his thinking, I think, plays out. The relationship between active opposition to Pakistan, as found in the volunteer movements, and the promotion of a majoritarian position on Hindi were directly related and espoused simultaneously, for example. So Tandon's chairmanship of the 31st Hindi Sahitya Sammelan, between the 17th and 19th of May 1943, and deliberately entertained among its alumni representatives of the volunteer organisations, the Mahabir Dal and the RSS. In April 1945, as well as collecting funds for Hindi Sahitya Sammelan Bhavan in Jaipur, Tandon supported Sampurnanand's criticism by the UP provincial Sammelan of the pro-Urdu policy, allegedly, at All India Radio. In the same month, at the Kangri Gurukul in Western UP, in the Western UP district of Saharanpur, Tandon was again vocal about his opposition to Gandhian non-violence. The promotion of Hindi then became a vehicle for the development of an exclusively defined majoritarian concept of citizenship, in which linguistic difference potentially positioned the nation's denizens. And so we also see, in continuing through the mid-1940s, the inviting of some of the members of the far-right organisations, some of these Hindi language events. But it was shortly after independence that these totalising representations of Indian culture were developed most directly into exclusive and ethnicised ideas of citizenship. At an open meeting of the Hindi Sahitya Sammelan in the spring of 1948, Tandon suggested that the use of Hindi should be a means of testing Muslim loyalty to India. If the socialists supported Urdu-inflected Hindustani, Tandon argued, they would be continuing to support the two-nation theory. The country's salvation lay instead of everybody having, in Tandon's words, one culture and civilization. Muslims therefore had to, quote, own the Indian culture and civilization like they have done in China. The partition of the country for Tandon was an illustration of the failure of this monolithic nation, which naturally revolved around Hindu culture. Tandon argued in the UP Assembly that the reason for this, as it were, failure of this project was due to the past sins of Hindus, and that if they did not open the doors of Hinduism to Muslims, they would experience worse grief. Tandon's correspondence then also shows a support for organisations that sought to directly question the citizenship rights of Muslims in this early post-colonial phase, including an All India Refugee Association, a Sindhi-dominated organisation headed by Jyotiram P. Gidwani. The association had developed out of refugee agitations for property compensation and directly lobbied the Prime Minister's office. And Tandon was seen as a key supporter with the association in seeking to help with rent disputes and preventing the recovery of income tax demands issued on Sindhi refugees by the Pakistani authorities. Indeed, his stance on refugees and Muslim properties was a key dynamic of Tandon's dispute with Nehru himself. And the All India Refugee Association spared no ire in denouncing Nehru as a man whose culture was Muslim and who showed too much open appeasement of Pakistan. The role of these organisations had a material effect, you could argue, on the substantive citizenship rights of Muslim communities in some instances. In 1950, the Sindhi Hindu refugee panchayat based in Jaipur wrote to Tandon for help in preventing Muslims from selling and mortgaging properties in Rajasthan. The panchayat provided lists of Muslim government servants who had retained properties but migrated or who had deceived refugees. In 1950, Tandon presided over the All India Refugee Conference in Delhi, in which the speech of Chotiram Gidwani complained of inadequacy of refugee loans, suggested that the evacuee property law had failed to prevent a drain of crores of rupees from India to Pakistan. Tandon, if we look at these the correspondence between these organisations in Tandon's own collections, we see that he helped a whole range of different organisations, refugee organisations, helping them to manoeuvre the everyday state, you could say, in the context of this majoritarian worldview of citizenship rights. Other correspondents to Tandon requested help in acquiring evacuee property, such as one PR Krishna Chand, also from Sindh, who wanted help acquiring a shop in Kanpur, or the letter of a complaint sent by the District Refugee Corporation about a rationing officer and the inadequacy of his calls for tenders for evacuee properties. And this led to a host of other smaller colonies of displaced persons seeking Tandon support, including the